Okay, this is lecture number two in our series on series of lectures on ethics. We were talking about the three types of moral relativism, only six major ethical systems. Three of them are moral relativist positions, and three of them are moral absolutist positions. And what we're going to do is try to refute the relativist position in the bulk of this lecture. So we're really going to put these three, antinomianism, situation ethics, and generalism, the three moral relativist positions, on the back burner. And what I'm doing right now is I'm arguing that the best moral absolutist position would be the graded absolutism, or the greater good doctrine, okay? By graded, what they mean is that some of God's moral commands are more important than others, okay? Some guy comes to your house and holds you at gunpoint and says, "Where's your wife? I want to shoot her." And you think, well, it would be a sin for me to lie. She's in the bedroom hiding under the bed. And then the guy goes there and shoots her, and you're going to act like you didn't do anything wrong. No, in that situation, you either say nothing or you lie through your teeth, because God's going to give you an exemption from the lesser law to obey the greater good and to save innocent human life. By the way, it's the same way it goes for self-defense. God says, "Thou shalt not kill." At the same time, the Bible says you can defend yourself or defend your nation. And we're going to talk about just war criteria. And so in a cursed creation, certain commands of God are going to come into conflict, not because God's commands are messed up, but because the world is messed up. We live in a fallen creation. Things aren't the way that they should be. We're now in an abnormal state because of the fall. God said, "If you eat from the forbidden fruit, you should surely die." Evil and human suffering has come into the picture. And so now we've got to weigh things. And when you think, well, hey, I love going to church 10 times a week, and it's just so much fun, and I enjoy it so much, and the Lord's really blessing me, and your wife says, "I feel like a widow. You're never home. You leave me watching the kids, and you're always going up." Well, there, going to church is good, but keeping your marriage intact and treating your wife the way she should be treated would also come into play. And so some of God's commands hold more weight than others. And we were talking about graded absolutism, the greater good doctrine. When absolute moral laws sometimes conflict, we are obligated to obey the higher law. Therefore, lying would actually sometimes be the right thing to do because there are higher laws, and we would receive an exemption from bearing false witnesses. In other words, if Rahab the harlot had told the truth at that particular time and those guys had gotten killed, that would have been the wrong thing to do. But because she lied and saved their lives, she did not have to confess that as sin, and that's why God throughout the scriptures compliments her for what she did. It is viewed throughout the scriptures as an act of obedience and an act of faith, not as something that she did. But again, it was not an exception, because there are no exceptions. Instead, it's an exemption. Okay? And that we're really splitting hairs, but they're hairs that need to be split at this point. But when they come into conflict with two of God's moral laws, we're obligated to obey the higher law. A person who lies to save a life receives an exemption from the law against lying. Absolute laws allow no exceptions, but they do allow exemptions. Okay? And there is a difference. If there was exceptions, it wouldn't be an absolute law. It would be a general law. But as an absolute law, there are no exceptions, but you can receive an exemption. Say, well, God say, okay, that law still stands. Thou shalt not bear false witness still stands. However, Tom, in this particular case, I'm giving you an exemption from it, but the law is still there. It's not an area where the law wasn't there. The law is still there, but you're receiving an exemption from it. What this tells us, and I believe this is the proper view, the true view, I agree with Geisler here. The situation never determines what is right. God determines what is right. Okay, the situation, this is why situation ethics is false. The situation never determines what is right. God determines what is right. That's why we have to read His Word and find out which commands are of higher importance than other commands. Still, the situation can aid us in determining which of God's laws should be applied. Okay? Now, the scriptural support for this, Joshua chapter 2, you have Rahab the harlot telling these lies to the government officials and to save the lives of the Jewish spies. Well, what does James say about that? In James chapter 2, verse 25, he says, "And in the same way was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way?" James in chapter 2, verse 20. By the way, James is probably the, when it comes to morale, issues of morality, what is right and what is wrong, you don't get any tougher than James. Again, James is Jesus' little brother. He's his half-brother. Mary was his mother. And all through life, no matter how good James was, people would say, "James, why can't you be more like your big brother Jesus?" His big brother was God. His big brother was perfect. And so James here writes the most morally demanding book in the entire Bible. Yet he says that lie that Rahab the harlot told, that was a work through which she was justified. By the way, I don't want to get into the big discussion on faith and works and all. The Bible teaches Christians don't do good works to get saved. It teaches they do good works because they are saved. However, when Paul says faith, Paul means a heart commitment and a heart belief in Jesus Christ as Savior, which then produces good works in your life. Transforms your life. That's what Paul means when he says faith. When James says faith, he means only head knowledge. Intellectual agreement. Intellectual acknowledgement of certain scriptural doctrines. Okay? So James would say, in order to be saved, you need faith plus works. But what James means when he says faith plus works, that's what Paul means when he says faith alone. Okay? True faith produces good works. And so what James is saying is, if all you have is intellectual assent to a doctrinal statement of faith, that's not enough. It's also got to transform your life. So faith without works is dead. But anyway, we're getting back to Rahab the harlot. He says that she was justified by what she did there. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. It says, "By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace." Because she lied, she had done it by faith, she lied by faith, and saved their lives, and because of that, she was spared while the other Canaanites were killed by the conquering Jews. So the book of Hebrews says that she did that by faith. So what is it? She received an exemption because she was obeying a greater good, and saving innocent human life is a greater good than telling the truth. I would think, and I disagree with guys who are here, because I don't think he's consistent. He should apply this to the abortion movement. If trespassing and disobeying the government saves a human life, then I think that the pro-lifers have a good argument from the greater good doctrine for doing that. Now, Geisler argues, we're going to see when we get to that how he argues, but I disagree with the way he's arguing there. I think it can be applied there. Now, I'm not saying that therefore God is calling all of us to do that, nor am I saying that in the long run that's going to work best for the pro-life movement. I think it ends up making us look more like fanatics. But I will not tell these people like Geisler will that they're out of God's will when they do it, when they walk over to me with a 4-year-old kid that 4 years ago the kid's life was saved because they trespassed. And by the way, the trespassing they're doing are sidewalks that public, that people, our taxpayers' money is paying for. So it became trespassing after the fact, rather than it being trespassing right from the beginning. Submission to government. Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 7 tells us to submit to the governing authorities. Well, the Jewish religious leaders, they were the government authorities over the Israelites. Now, Rome had the maximal power there, but the Jewish religious leaders did have a certain amount of power. Well, when they told the apostles to stop preaching in Jesus' name in Acts chapter 5, in Acts chapter 5, verses 27 and 29, the apostles said we must obey God rather than men. They said, yes, God wants us to submit to the governing authorities. Even Jesus brought this out. He said, well, they said, should we pay taxes? Whose face is on this coin? Whose image is on this coin? Caesar. Well, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but give to God what is God's. Well, what is he saying? He's saying, submit to the governing authority when it demands what it deserves. But when the governing authority demands what only God deserves, such as when Caesar demands to be worshipped, you don't submit to the governing authorities. You receive an exemption, and you obey the greater good. We've mentioned already healing on the Sabbath and how Christ dealt with that. See if I can dig up that one passage. Yeah, they refused to submit to the governing authorities. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You also have Daniel when he was tossed into the lion's den. Look at John chapter 7, verse 23. Healing on the Sabbath. Jesus healed on the Sabbath. And Jesus says this in defense of himself. He didn't say, hey, look, I didn't do any work on the Sabbath. That's not what he said. He said, if a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? You see, he's saying, you guys break the Sabbath law, and you are willing to circumcise on the Sabbath, recognizing that circumcision is a greater law than the law, the command not to work on the Sabbath. You guys will work on the Sabbath when you recognize that circumcision is a greater command. And so he says, well, why can't I make an entire man well on the Sabbath by healing him? Then Christ says in verse 24, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. And it's kind of getting at the spirit of the law more than just the letter of the law. Also, the Hebrew midwives in Egypt. We don't have time to turn here, but in Exodus chapter 1, verses 15 to 22, the Pharaoh said, look, these Israelites are getting more numerous than us. We're going to have to start killing them off. So, if a male child is born, we'll tell the Egyptian midwives, or the midwives, will tell them to slaughter the child. Well, the ladies didn't want to do that, so they lied through their teeth. And they said, no, these Israelite women are strong women. Before we even get a chance to get there, they've already had their babies. Now, we're not going to go chasing down babies and killing them. We'll do what you tell us. You know, these ladies are lying through their teeth. But God compliments them. So I think that view, the graded absolutism, the greater good view, rather than the conflicting absolutism, the lesser evil view, would be the position to take there. So now what I want to do is, I've given scriptural support. By the way, good men disagree on a lot of issues, and you can disagree with me on that. Just give me the answers I want when it comes time for the test. But you can argue with me after the lectures are over. But I provided a defense of that as being the more scripturally sound view. But now I want to just in one sweeping move try to refute moral relativism. And so let's take a look at this. Moral relativism just basically teaches that each person decides what is right for himself. Okay? Each person decides what is right for himself. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, in fact, I should write his name on the board. So I'm saying, just spell it like it sounds, but that's not the way it goes. Nietzsche probably the most consistent atheist that ever lived.
I think that's the way it is.
Yeah. Okay. Nietzsche basically said that, and the dates when he lived are real important, 1844 to 1900, and we'll see why in a little while. But he said that if God is dead, what he meant was that he figured that through philosophy and through science, mankind had grown up to where we finally realized that God didn't create man, but man created God by his own imagination. And now that we've grown up, we realize that God really doesn't exist, and therefore our imagined God died. Okay? Now, atheists of his day were all in agreement with him. But he said, but we need to go a step further, guys. If God is dead, then all traditional values have died with him. That's important. If God is dead, then traditional values have died with him. You know, he said, you guys don't believe the God of the Bible exists, but you still uphold the moral values that are taught in the Bible. If God doesn't exist, we've got to throw out these traditional values too. He said we need a group of overmen, or a group of supermen, who should come on the scene and have the courage to create their own values with their will to power. In other words, guys that are hungry for power, and have the courage to create their own values. Not referring to a Bible like the weak Christians do, but have the courage to create their own values. In other words, Friedrich Nietzsche was one of the first modern atheists who recognized that without God there are no universal moral values. And he even said that Christianity gave us soft values, and he recommended hard values. Now, at that time, the Nazi movement started coming on the scene, and they were anti-Semitic, they hated Jews, and they were referring to his writings as a philosophical justification for it. Now he said, no, that's totally wrong, that's messed up. And he said that you shouldn't hate a people just because of their nationality. But what's the problem here? The problem is once you throw out universal moral laws, you have no right to call anything wrong. What Nietzsche failed to understand was, given if his assumptions are true, then you have no way to call the Nazis wrong. But Adolf Hitler loved the writings of Nietzsche, even though Nietzsche, he died before Hitler came to power, but Nietzsche would have probably vomited knowing that this guy was using his teachings to do it. But I'll tell you, I don't even think that the Nazis really took him out of context. I think Nietzsche, as consistent as he was with his atheism, failed to see the logical consequences of his own views. That when you say, if God is dead, then all traditional values have died with him, and then you believe that God is dead, when them values have died, they are dead. And it's anybody's ballgame. And when the supermen come on the scene, by the way, the supermen were everything that Nietzsche was not. He was physically weak. He was not very courageous. He ended up spending his last 2 years in an insane asylum, and then they let him spend his last year dying at home. I think he died of a venereal disease. But the thing about Nietzsche was that he wanted these supermen, but the supermen were everything that he wasn't. And anybody here seen Schindler's List?
No.
There's a lot of garbage in there too. They throw in some sex scenes and stuff. I spend most of my time looking at my feet in the theater. Took my wife and daughter, and my wife had to tell me when it was okay to look up there, and it was too bad. They ruined a really good movie, but they really played up the way the Germans were convinced they were the master race, they were superior, and that everybody else was like beasts next to them. It shows them blowing guys away, but then seeing a piano, so one of the Nazis puts his rifle down and starts playing classical music, and then these other Germans are standing there real prideful trying to guess what classical performer he was. And they didn't really see that they saw other people as animals, and they saw themselves as the most civilized people, the supermen, the master race, when in actuality They were the animals. They were the barbarians who were butchering people. Yeah, Tom?
Well, what's really interesting about that is, I was watching something here a while back. I was taping the radio when he was talking about, I think it was Norman Geisler, and he was talking, and he linked Darwin and Karl Marx.
Yeah, yeah.
And where Karl Marx dedicated one of his books.
Wanted to. Karl Marx wanted to dedicate, I believe it was the Communist Manifesto, might have been one of his other writings, wanted to dedicate it to Charles Darwin, and Charles Darwin refused. But when you read Darwin's stuff, man, hey, our founding father said all men are created equal. Charles Darwin did not say all men evolved equally. He taught that you could look at the features of men from different races and tell who was closer to the apes than who. And when, at that time, he wrote it 1859, 1860, they didn't, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't come until 1863, so Charles Darwin was a man of his times, and they viewed Afro-Americans as being less than human, and that came out in his writings, and but I don't think there's any way to justify that all men have evolved equally. You could say all men are created equal, and even if we're not equal in our own eyes, if we all came from God, and then we're all in His family, and then we all deserve equal rights. But if evolution is true, you don't have that to fall back on. Second guy I'd like to touch. Did you have something else, Tom?
No.
Okay. Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell. He lived from 1872 to 1970. He died at 98 years old. British philosopher and mathematician. He said, outside of human desires, there is no moral standard. So, in other words, what he's saying is, when you say murder is wrong, what you're really saying is, I don't like murder, so I desire it to be wrong. Okay? That's a really weak view, because, you know, what if a person desires to kill? How are you going to convince Adolf Hitler is coming at you with an axe, and now you got to convince him not to do what he's doing, and you're going to tell him, outside human desires, there is no moral standard, and Hitler says, yeah, well, I desire to kill you. By the way, Bertrand Russell, for a guy who said that, he protested against more things. He protested, he was a conscientious objector to World War I, and protested against World War I. He led the way protesting against treatment of homosexuals. He was for equal rights for homosexuals back in the 1920s or 1930s. I mean, this guy protested at the drop of a hat and stood up for what he felt was right, but then he teaches that outside human desires there is no moral standard. By the way, he debated the Jesuit priest Father Frederick Copleston back in the 40s, and Copleston was a genius, and Copleston tore him up, and that was one of the main issues that he tore him up on, was Bertrand Russell's view on what is right and what is wrong. And A.J. Ayer, who died not too long ago, he had a near-death experience where he felt that there was this tremendous red light that was judging him, that was the moral governor of the universe was judging his every deed. And then he came out of that, and they asked him, do you believe that God exists now? And he said, no, I can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm too entrenched in my ways. And so then he died a few months later, still being an atheist. But he says that moral commands, he said the same thing, basically. Moral commands express one's subjective feelings. So there's no objective right and wrong. It's just, it feels good to me. Loving others feels good to me, so I do it. But the problem is, Mr. Ayer, killing people felt good to Ted Bundy. And if you don't have an objective standard of what is right and what is wrong, you can't say that Phil Fernandez is right for loving people and Ted Bundy is wrong for killing people. And but there was A.J. Ayer. Jean-Paul Sartre. Now, The dictionary, the encyclopedia says you pronounce that as Sartre. Okay? And I usually go with the World Book Encyclopedia and their pronunciation. However, on Larry King Live once, I heard Sartre was a Marxist, and one of his best friends, a fellow Marxist, after Sartre had died, years after he had died, was being interviewed, and he pronounced his name, the guy was French, Sartre was French, and he pronounced his name Sartre. So I don't know, you know, World Book Encyclopedia says Sartre, but I've been calling him Sartre ever since. I mean, if his best friends who speak the same language, I can call him Sartre, you know, I don't know, we'll find out one of these days how it's supposed to pronounce it, but his buddy's called. But anyway, he's a French existentialist. He was a French existentialist, lived from 1905 to 1980, Jean-Paul Sartre. And he thought that there's no objective meaning to life. And that's basically what an existentialist is. You create your own meaning to life. So therefore, in the realm of moral values, man must create his own values. Man must create his own values, okay? And he would say too, and by the way, existentialism, he did not borrow a whole lot from psychologists. He did not borrow as much from psychologists as psychologists had borrowed from him. Psychologists borrow more from the philosophers than philosophers borrow from the psychologists. In other words, behind each psychology, there's usually somebody's philosophy on the other end. But Sartre said that we need to actualize ourselves. We need to be self-actualized. And what Sartre says, it doesn't matter whether you help the old lady across the street, whether you help the old lady cross the street, or whether you grab her and steal her purse or throw her in front of a moving bus, it's irrelevant. The fact is you actualized yourself, you gave meaning to your life. And so, you know, that's where Sartre took it. There's no objective meaning to life. Man must create his own values. What you subjectively believe is way more important than any objective truth, and then he would say there really isn't any objective truth. Now, again, Sartre protested more than anybody. At the drop of a hat, this guy's out there leading the march, and there's all signs out, and they're complaining about something. You know, hey, if people want to, you know, want to actualize themselves in this way or that way, what right does he have to tell them they're wrong? If there's no objective meaning to life, what does it matter? Hedonism. We talked about hedonism earlier. Whatever brings the most pleasure. Whatever brings pleasure is right. If it feels good, do it. And again, surgery doesn't feel good, but sometimes that's the right thing to do. And there's a problem with that. We talked about utilitarianism. Utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. Who decides, though? You have to get some intellectual elite who are going to arbitrarily say this is right and this is wrong, because when you try to work for the greatest good for the greatest number, you already have to have good defined. So some of these intellectuals have to define for us what is good. You know, by the way, along these lines, B.F. Skinner with behaviorism, there is a whole lot of, he believed that man is controlled, man really isn't free, he is controlled by either genetics or his upbringing or his culture, his environment, and so he believed that we should, you know, there's really no such thing as right and wrong, because you don't have free will, okay, so you just do what you're forced to do by what you've inherited, plus by your culture. So he figured we should change the culture and genetically engineer people and make the kind of people that, you know, make the kind of people that would be good people, and so we would have the greatest good for the greatest number. The problem with that is that if B.F. Skinner is right, the only reason why he came to that conclusion was not because he freely came to that conclusion, but because he was programmed, just like everybody else, to come to that conclusion. And then secondly, if there's no such thing as objective right and wrong, somebody has to arbitrarily decide what is right and wrong. And lo and behold, there are all the people, B.F. Skinner's friends, the secular humanists, you know, Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2, all these atheists that got together, and they are going to randomly determine what is right and what is wrong.
Well, what's really sad about that is a lot of the Christian psychologists also believe that Skinner is right.
There's a real... See, and the thing is, too, you can use some of his principles to a certain degree. For instance, you can... When I was a little boy, if you wanted me to make my bed, you could program me by promising me a cookie. So it can work to a certain degree. But there's a difference between a dog and a human being. And so you can't take it too far, but there's only a certain degree. Now, I think the Christian psychologists that you're talking about, I would say they go way too far with a lot of Skinner's views. Again, every psychology has got somebody's philosophy behind it. And true Christian philosophy is going to be consistent with the Word of God. All other philosophies, and by philosophy what I mean is a worldview, an attempt at gaining truth and finding truth and finding wisdom. But any anti-Christian philosophy is probably going to bring up anti-Christian solutions and conclusions. Problems. Some of the problems with moral relativism. When one denies God's absolute moral law, once you deny God's absolute moral law, and then you proclaim the actions of another person evil, such as Adolf Hitler, you have to resurrect some type of absolute standard in order to make the value judgment. C.S. Lewis said this real well. He said, every time we make a moral value judgment, we are assuming that there is an objective standard of right and wrong that is above all men. And so when you say Adolf Hitler was wrong, you're assuming that moral relativism is false and there is an absolute moral law which stands qualitatively above all men. Okay? I saw a television debate once between a Jewish rabbi and a homosexual about whether or not homosexuals should be able to teach in the New York City public school system. And the Jewish rabbi was against it, and the homosexual was for it. The homosexual asked the rabbi, why do you think that homosexuals should not be able to teach at public school? And the Jewish rabbi said, because homosexuality is a sin. And the guy turned to the Jewish rabbi and the homosexual and said, you can't say that. You're making a moral value judgment. So the Jewish rabbi smiled and held his hands up and said, okay, for now I'll concede that point to you. You say we're not supposed to make moral value judgments. I'll just concede that point to you right now. He didn't say anything. A little while later, the Jewish rabbi started reading an article about a homosexual who not only wanted the right to teach in the public schools, but also wanted the right to have sex with high school-age boys. As he was reading it, the homosexual got mad and said, but I disagree with him. I don't think... This and I started complaining. And so finally, the rabbi said, why do you disagree with him? And the homosexual said, because he's wrong. And at that point, the Jewish rabbi smiled and said, you can't say that. You're making a moral value judgment. And so the question is not, this is real important. I don't care if it's in the realm of politics or whatever. The question is not, are there any boundaries, are there any lines to be drawn in the moral arena? That is not the question. Lines have to be drawn. Even if we say there are no lines to be drawn, we just drew a line. Okay? We just called everybody wrong who draws lines. Moral boundaries have to be set up. The question is not, do there have to be moral boundaries? But they're there. The question is, whose boundaries are we going to accept? Okay? Geraldine Ferraro, when she was running for vice president, said you can't mix morality and government. If you don't mix morality and government, all the government officials All they have left to do is pick up their paychecks on Friday. Because the government has to say, thou shalt not kill. And then it has to enforce those laws. So morality and government, government has to enforce morality, somebody's morality. The question isn't, should government mix with morality? The question is, whose morality is the government going to enforce? Okay? Yeah, Tom.
Well, there's two cases right now that where the government is in agreement with morality. One is held, one is being held in Pennsylvania, where a circus worker had a medical interlude with a sheep. They're trying to draw bestiality. And the second, Clinton's second-hand man is a supporter of NAMBLA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a
National Association of Man,
Boy, Lovers Association. Yeah.
See, and every time a police officer makes an arrest, he's acting as a government official, and he's enforcing certain moral laws. The government, you know, that was just—it was a popular statement for that time to be made, but it was a very easy statement to be refuted when Geraldine Ferraro made that. But problems with moral relativism. So let's see. We all recognize evil acts, even if we deny that there's such a thing as right and wrong. We all recognize evil actions when we are wrong. Okay. Guy says, there's no such thing as right and wrong. But then you steal some money from him, and lo and behold, he calls the police. Okay? There's no such thing as right and wrong, but you punch him in the nose, and he punches you back. We all recognize evil actions when we're the one who's wrong. Christ made a very profound statement in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. He said, do to others what you would have them do to you. You see, he recognized, he said, do to others, treat others the way you think they should be treated. We would treat others lousy because we don't hold them in as high esteem as we hold ourselves. But if we think about how we would like them to treat us, well, I'm Phil Fernandez, I like to be treated like a king. Well, Jesus says, okay, well then Fernandez, go, you start treating other people like kings and queens. But Christ recognized that we recognize evil not when we do it, but when other people do it to us. And that's when, even a moral relativist, if you do evil to him, you know, these guys will say there is no such thing as right and wrong, but then they finish the lecture and they go home, and if their wife leaves them, they feel like they've been wrong. Or if their wife divorces them and tries to take everything that they've got, they say, no, I'm going to stand up for my rights. And this and that. That's unethical what she's doing to me. This is the same guy that when he lectures in a philosophy hall says there is no such thing as right and wrong. But now he feels like he's being wrong. The definition of the absolute moral law is given by Geisler and Feinberg in their Introduction to Philosophy, A Christian Perspective. By a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. By a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. Again, unless, of course, you get an exemption. In other words, there are no exceptions to it. The rule is always there and always binding, but God can give you an exemption, but there's no exceptions to that universal right. That's the absolute moral law. The Bible declares God's absolute moral law. Man's conscience also reveals God's absolute moral law. Remember Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. God's law is written on our hearts. Now, we consider our consciences. We do a great job at it. That's one of the reasons why we need the Bible, even apart from salvation, just in the area of knowing right from wrong. Because we justify ourselves so much. I blew my top at somebody earlier today. And there's a lot of ways I could justify. And the guy was not being nice to me. The guy, to my face, knowing I'm a preacher and all, I said something and he accused me of lying right then and there. And I basically spoke a little louder than him and reminded him that not only am I a pastor, I'm kind of bigger than him too. And, you know, that type of thing. And I felt real bad. We had the Lord's Supper and I had to do some heavy examining my conscience. But we like to justify it. You know, we like to say, you know, It was called for. That was righteous anger. Well, the guy needs to know that you don't just call people liars without investigating what they said. At the same time, it wasn't justified. I blew my top and I was wrong. But we like to do that. We like to justify. When I do it, it's okay. Now, when Tom Thompson does it, he might need some pastoral counseling. But when I do it, it's okay. But the moral law, this is what we mentioned earlier, the moral law in the last lecture is not above God, because nothing is above God. If there's anything above God, then God is no longer God, and whatever is above God, that becomes God. God is the supreme. He is the ultimate. So the moral law is not above God. At the same time, the moral law is not arbitrary. God doesn't just randomly say, okay, I think I'll make murder wrong and love right. It's not arbitrary. Murder is wrong because murder is wrong. It's not arbitrary. So the moral law is not above God. Nothing is above God. And the moral law is not arbitrary. But the moral law flows naturally from God's good nature. Okay? The moral law flows naturally from God's good nature, so that God is the only thing that God is subject to, God's will. The only thing that God's will is subject to is His own good nature. God is not subject to anything outside of Himself, but His will is subject to and answerable to His good nature. In other words, God will not will something unless it's in accordance with His good nature. So the standard of what is good, the standard of what is good is not above God. God is the standard. See, we have love, but God is love. We can have goodness, but God is good. Okay? So God, since God is good, God is the standard of what is right and wrong. And His will is dependent upon His good nature. He only wills things in accordance with His good nature. So the standard is not above God. God is the standard. Let me give you a real quick argument for the absolute moral law. Number one, the moral law doesn't come from within each individual. Okay? For then we couldn't call the actions of another person wrong. Again, Hitler's atrocities. So the moral law doesn't come from within each individual. Number two, the moral law doesn't come from each society, because then one society couldn't call the actions of another society wrong. And America couldn't call Nazi Germany wrong for the atrocities that they did. Number three, the moral law doesn't come from a world consensus. I mean, what if the world consensus was split right down the middle? Well, could something be both right and wrong? Plus, world consensus is not infallible. At one time, the world consensus thought the earth was flat and that slavery was okay. And by the way, all world consensus in society is society. You just add individuals up and get a society. World consensus, you just add societies up. All you're doing is getting, it only adds men. It just gets quantitatively bigger. But what we need is a moral law qualitatively above man. Not quantitatively above men. This isn't a democratic vote. Okay, 75 people say it's right, therefore it's right. 25 people say, well, look at all the backing we're doing for minorities, minority rights, and that's good. Okay? But minorities would have no rights if the majority rules. So in order to make moral judgments, in order to call the actions of somebody else wrong, we need a moral law that is objectively and qualitatively above man. Yet, a moral law that is above man, a moral law, is nonsense unless it comes from a moral lawgiver. A moral law above man needs a moral lawgiver who is above man. Because the moral law is not descriptive of what is, but it's prescriptive of what should be. When you get prescriptive drugs, it's because it was prescribed to you by a pharmacist. When you find an objective moral law that it's above man, an absolute moral law that it's above man, somebody had to prescribe it. There needs to be a moral lawgiver. Okay? So the moral law doesn't come from within each individual, doesn't come from each society, doesn't come from a world consensus. A moral law which is qualitatively above man needs a moral lawgiver which is qualitatively above man. And that, of course, is what the Christian calls the God of the Bible. Okay, we'll close that lecture there. In the next lecture, we're going to deal with abortion.